The Invocation by D. Vincent de Palo, Movement 2. Chapter 2, Carlo and Roberto.
Carlo, guardi chi ho trovato!
Cried Roberto, gesturing to us like a proud fruit seller displaying his produce. Carlo closed the distance with freakish rapidity, first embracing Emma and then bowing to Paul and myself with little bobs of his head. He slid his arm around Roberto's waist and stood there grinning. Side by side, the resemblance was uncanny. I couldn't understand how I hadn't made the connection before.
My friends,
Carlo said, and his accent was exactly the same as Roberto's.
What joy to be on holiday together. Have you been here long?
Away from a concert hall or rehearsal studio, Paul, though still an imposing figure, didn't have quite the same authority he had in those, his own elements. And though by this time he had grown to thoroughly dislike Molino, he wasn't quite ready to be openly rude. In fact, Paul was never openly rude. He was either civil or physically belligerent, and Molino's small stature precluded the latter, so for lack of willingness to offend, we found ourselves saddled with Carlo and Roberto, our evening strolls encumbered by Carlo and Roberto, our eventual rescheduled tour of the Hagia Sophia ruined by Carlo and Roberto, even our sumptuous villa invaded by Carlo and Roberto. For the next 6 days, in fact, we could do nothing without seeing them, either by chance or by prearrangement.
Is the damned fool following me around?
Paul said one day in exasperation. I had left him earlier at the public baths where both Roberto and Carlo had suddenly joined him, orbiting like twin Jovian moons. Were they in there with you?
What do you think? Of course, it was awful. Carlo was... it was inhuman. Grotesque.
What are you talking about, Paul? What did he do?
Not what he did, Surin. It was his... member.
It took me a moment to digest this. Then, when I understood, I realized for the first time just how deeply Paul was in competition with this ugly little man. Paul, they say... Emma says, even, that size doesn't...
It wasn't just big, brother,
he said, grimacing.
It was horrible, dark, and barbed or scarred somehow. My God, to expose himself like that, and in a public bath.
Emma strolled out of the bedroom dressed in a silk kimono and smoking. In fact, we had just finished making love when Paul had come hollering into the villa.
What about Roberto?
She asked with a smile.
Was he the same?
No, but the man is a gorilla, covered, literally covered with hair. He actually combed his chest and underarms in the bath. The whole thing was disgusting, you have no idea.
I'd never seen Paul so shaken. He went to the piano and banged out some cascading chromatic octaves, holding the pedal down till the volume was almost deafening. Once that was out of his system, he began puzzling through an impenetrable Scriabin etude, transposing the left and right hands independently to make it that much more mind-consuming. Emma gave me a look, and we retired back into the smoke-filled boudoir. The next evening could rightly be described as the beginning of the end. Though who can tell when anything truly begins? Was it the splitting of the atom, or the dropping of the bomb which marked the beginning of the atomic age? Paul and Emma and I were refreshed and looking forward to having dinner on the Bosphorus. We hadn't seen Carlo or Roberto all day, and there was little chance of meeting them on the boat. It was to be the culinary high point of our trip. An ultra-exclusive floating restaurant with only 8 tables. A French chef, a 12-course pre-fix meal, including matching wines, views of moonlit Istanbul and the luminous Bosphorus. The whole thing available only for the first 2 weeks in August. It was the most well-kept secret in Istanbul. We had just been seated, smiling as the captain ordered the crew to let go the slip, when Carlo and Roberto appeared sweating and grinning on the gangplank.
What joy!
Carlo cried, kissing Emma's hand. She smiled and looked him up and down, trying to gauge the validity of Paul's earlier remarks, no doubt.
You must join us, of course,
she said, and a gurgle sounded from Paul's belly. Roberto deferred to Carlo, who bowed, and so the table was rearranged. I could sense Paul's discomfort. I didn't quite hate Molino then, I just didn't trust him. How could anyone trust a man who wrote such abrasive music? Yet I knew there was this stylistic rift between Paul and he, and while they had always avoided direct disagreement in the past, mainly by never spending any time alone together, there was virtually no way for them to avoid it over a dinner scheduled to last more than 3 hours. At first, both Carlo and Roberto were actually quite agreeable, complimenting the exquisite amuse-bouche, the champagne, the ship's sumptuous design, and even Emma's hair, which she'd twisted in the French style. But they weren't part of our little group, and it was something of a struggle to keep the conversation flowing. We all knew Carlo represented this other camp. He was a modernist to put Berio and Carter to shame. Compared to Molino, Ligeti was a mere jingle writer. So there was this constant hesitation between subjects, as if we were all weighing what to say, trying to look ahead like chess players, wary to the danger each move might expose. Thus, when Carlo finally did bring up the subject in a lull after the first remove, it came almost as a relief.
So, Paul, what are your plans now? What will you do with your music?
Just the way he said it suggested a certain disdain. He never referred to music itself, always my or your or their music. Paul poured himself another glass of wine. He was drinking far too much.
My music?
He said.
I mean to take it with me, of course.
Roberto clapped his hands and roared with laughter. Carlo simply showed his little teeth. The waiters arrived then, set down their trays, and in a coordinated flourish lifted the pewter covers to reveal 5 Turkish doves covered in a glistening wine sauce. Emma gasped. The heads were still on, complete with tiny protruding blue tongues. Çok güzel, I said, patting her on the thigh. Carlo reached over the table and cut the head off Emma's bird, transferring it to his own bread plate.
You don't have to eat it,
he explained.
It is only a custom of the Turks, you see.
She smiled gamely, but her composure had deserted her. It was strangely disquieting, as well as a shame, because the bird was quite delicious. I was eventually able to persuade her to take a few bites, but I had to feed her like a baby and she refused to even look at the plate. Incredibly, by the time I had begun dissecting Emma's first bite, Carlo was done with his own bird, and done in such a way that it made me stare. His plate was clean. Not a speck of sauce remained, even the bread plate where Emma's head had been placed was pristine. Not a bone was left except for the bits still crunching between Carlo's baby-sized teeth. Roberto grinned, sucking on a thigh, and said,
Carlo loves his game. Eh, cugine?
Carlo nodded and held his glass away from the table, silently waiting for a waiter to refill it.
As for me?
He said, continuing the conversation.
I'm leaving England when I graduate. The English have dead ears. Their minds are filled with pudding. Yes, I think it is Berlin, or possibly Paris now.
What is?
Asked Emma.
The center, the place to be, where the music is new and hard and real.
What about America? They seem to... He cut me off with his harsh laugh, a disturbing sound like steel scraping on stone.
America? Seriously, Ambrose?
He scowled, seemed to recollect my nationality, and added,
No offense.
Then he looked to Paul.
Maybe for your music, though.
Paul's face grew dark. I grabbed Emma's hand under the table.
Perhaps,
he growled. He cleared his throat, then continued in a much lighter tone.
I believe Los Angeles can be revived. But you're right. I don't think they would appreciate what you have to offer, Molino.
I relaxed, impressed with Paul's perfectly tempered insolence. He could be subtle when he put his mind to it. Perhaps he was even enjoying himself. Another course was presented, a kind of open ravioli with lobster and some kind of fish roe.
Oh, of course you can always write the film music,
Carlo said, smiling down at his plate.
Like Morricone,
Roberto shouted, delighted to be able to join the conversation.
Like Shostakovich,
Emma said. Like Copland, I added.
Like John Williams,
Carlo said, looking right at Paul with a greasy smile. Paul laughed and lifted his glass.
For my award, I would very much like to thank Johannes Brahms, Johann Strauss, Johann Baptista Strauss, Joseph Strauss, Richard Strauss, Richard Wagner, Beethoven, Schubert, Haydn, Mendelssohn, Rimsky-Korsakov.
We laughed and stood for him. It was an old Dmitri Tiomkin Oscar speech, something Paul had heard during one of the soirees and retained word for word in that prodigious memory of his. Nothing could have put Molino in his place better. For the rest of the meal he was virtually mute, letting Roberto attend to the conversation while he ate ravenously, devouring every morsel on his plate as though the act of eating itself was new to him, something so rare it had to be cherished, even to the grinding of gristle and bone. It was only as the coffee pot was passing round the table that he came out of his funk and continued, again as though the conversation had never wandered from his original tangent.
But there are other uses for music, for talents such as ours, you know? There is a sacred music on the one hand, but we all know the state of the church these days, and then there are other, more difficult to define practices, let's call them occult, which have great use for the coordinated vibration of sound. Did you know this, Paul? Have you ever considered it?
Paul gave him a searching look, but it seemed that Molino for once was speaking in earnest.
I have considered a requiem,
Paul said.
Just to have ready, in case, you know, something posthumous. But I must say I have no idea what else you're talking about.
Really? Because I remember seeing all those scores to the various Faust settings in your studio at one of those parties. I was so impressed that you had the Schnittke. I thought for sure that you were an initiate.
I glanced at Emma to see if she was paying attention. For some reason, I didn't want to be the only one privy to this conversation, as if later I might not remember it correctly, or if I did, I wouldn't believe it and would want her to corroborate it. And as I'd feared, as I'd known, because I could hear them, Emma and Roberto were having a drunken cigarette-rolling competition, each of them with their little yellow papers and tobacco in front of them, trying to see who could roll the most perfect tube.
True, I'm fascinated with the story,
Paul said.
And I think it's high time for a new opera on the subject, but I don't buy into the fantasy. Surely, Molino, you're not telling me that you believe in magic, are you?
Carlo still had some Vin Santo in his glass. He took a sip, and then held up the glass to the candle.
You see the liquid, yes? It is sweet wine. Holy wine, I think, is the exact translation.
He took another sip. We'd all had some, a delicate Altesino.
Now, we know that vinegar is made from wine, see? But it takes weeks to turn, even more when it is sweet. Agreed?
Paul nodded, dipping a biscuit into his own glass and munching on it. Carlo continued.
Suppose I told you that, with a combination of the right words and the exact vibration of those words, you could turn the wine into vinegar immediately. Would you call that magic then?
Well, if it worked, I suppose.
And you have no silly fears of demons and the like?
Of course not.
Good. But wait. You have the perfect pitch, yes?
A bell clanged on a nearby boy.
D flat.
Very well. So you will look into the glass and repeat after me, in the exact pitch and rhythm. Simple.
I looked to Emma and Roberto. They were in hysterics, now competing to see who could smoke their cigarillo the fastest. I hadn't seen Emma have so much fun since we'd had our last soiree. I didn't have the heart to interrupt. In any case, I felt certain that she would ignore me, that somehow Molino was controlling her inattention.
Almighty Satan,
he sang in a harsh, croaking screech.
The one true God who livest and reignest amongst men, I entreat thee to manifest before me.
Paul raised his eyebrow, but I heard him repeat the words exactly.
Oh, mighty Satan.
The strange inflection and pitches God exact to the microtone, though of necessity an octave lower.
I entreat thee, I command thee
to enter the form of this wine, to transform it into vinegar,
to remake it in thy name, to bend it to my will. Not sooner, but now, mighty Satan, the one true Father, patron of all mankind, I command thee now.
Carlo hissed and spat the last word, and Paul imitated that too. A cool wind blew across the deck. Our candle spluttered and went out. Paul sat up and grimaced, and I recognized the look of intestinal discomfort. A discharge was imminent. Carlo sniffed his wine and smiled.
Well?
Paul sipped his own. His face betrayed nothing.
You must excuse me for a moment.
And he was off to the bathroom. The waiters, taking their cue from the captain who was about to dock, cleared away the table just as I was reaching to sample Paul's glass. I spluttered something, trying to get it back, but they seemed not to hear me. I looked over to Molino. In spite of everything meaning to share my exasperation, and was shocked to find him watching me with an almost predatory smile. That night and all the next day, Paul was violently ill. We had all eaten the same food. Nevertheless, the doctor, a bent, ill-looking, pallid-faced man from the consulate, diagnosed him with food poisoning and left us with a bottle of chalky blue syrup, acid giderici, with which we were to dose him after each bout of emesis. It wasn't until late afternoon of the following day that he was stable enough to have any sort of conversation. He was still exhausted, but I had to find out. Paul, could it have been the wine, maybe?
We all had the wine,
he groaned. No, I mean afterwards, I saw what you and Carlo were up to. Did it work?
The bastard must have poisoned me,
he said with surprising conviction.
He could have put something in my glass when he handed it to me.
I sighed, a part of me glad to have this confirmation of the attempt, the other afraid to find out if it had worked. But had it changed? Was it vinegar? He was laying on his side in bed, a bucket on the floor at the ready. He turned his head and peered up at me.
I had just dipped a biscotti, you know, so that could have changed the taste, but by God it was bitter. I don't know if I would call it vinegar, but it sure as hell wasn't the Vin Santo we'd started with.
The villa was spacious, but not large enough to have a piano in the bedroom. The piano, an ancient Petrov, so old it still had ivory keys, was in the drawing room, a light airy room with French doors opening to the balcony and the Bosphorus beyond. We spent much of our time there when Paul wasn't composing, and that was where Emma and I had our simple supper of bread and cheese that night, while Paul recuperated. Emma had an indifferent ear, but she could read music to a certain degree, enough to pick out a single line written fair on a sheet of paper. Thus she chilled me to the very marrow, causing me to drop both wine bottle and glass as I stood poring by the open balcony doors. She was plucking out a very strange tune, the melody, in fact, of the invocations sung the night before. Somehow, between his violent, almost continuous vomiting, Paul had managed to write down the tune, even so far as noting the extremely complex rhythms and pauses of the half-sung, half-spoken spell. Emma cried out,
Soren, that was the last bottle of the Sancerre.
She came hurrying round the piano to help me clean it up, abandoning the odious theme before its conclusion. You have been listening to The Invocation by D. Vincent DiPaolo. Follow along with the book, available in the Kindle store. See the link in the show notes. And do stay tuned for the next chapter.